Thus, the peculiar and invaluable qualities of human intelligence are spared these routine maneuvers and are allowed to concentrate on the unexpected and unusual situation. Thank you.
Again, I would like to point out that there are some chairs here in front, and for those of you who have to go to another session now, it'd be a good time to switch places. There's a few warm seats up here, if you like them, right here. For those who came late, I would like to very quickly repeat the way that we are running this particular session. We have four presentations, as opposed to the three that were in the preprint, of about 20 minutes each. You can submit questions in writing, but if you can't get to one of those pieces of paper, you can stand up and ask the question anyway, and I will have to repeat it since this whole session is being taped by the IEEE Educational Group for their tape library. After the four paper presentations, we will have a short break and then come back for a panel discussion, which the speakers will sit on the panel, and we will try and find out what intelligence is in instrumentation, that is. Our next speaker is Bruce Hamilton, and he has written the paper together with Louis Navarro, both from Tektronix. Bruce got his BSEE at Oregon State in between 62 and 66, and his MSEE at Ohio State, where he was from 66 to 68. From 66 to 69, he worked at Bell Telephone Laboratories, and from 69 to the present has been with Tektronix as the software project leader in the computer-aided measurements group of Tektronix. The title of his presentation is Intelligence in Acquisition, Processing, and Display. Bruce Hamilton.
Thank you, Rudy. Before I begin, I'd like to mention that if some of the things I say seem a little bit redundant, particularly in light of some of the things the first two speakers have said, or that you may have heard yesterday in the session on microprocessors, perhaps there's a message there. I think those working in the field have found that they all have a lot of common ideas. May I have the first slide, please? I'm going to be talking a little more generally than the first two speakers about the benefits of using intelligence in the three primary functions of acquisition, processing, and display. I think you'll notice that a lot of the examples they gave and a lot of the specific things they talked about will apply here also. To begin with, if you're not familiar by what we mean by acquisition, processing, and display, when we talk about these as three primary functions of instrumentation, let's consider some examples right quick. The reason that we have, let's drop back a second and take a look at some of the reasons that we want to use intelligence in the functions of acquisition, processing, and display. Probably the primary reason are the advances in technology over the last decade. As the slide shows, transistor cutoff frequencies have increased tremendously. If you got into this game before 1963, then this is not new knowledge to you. It looks like a lot of the faces out here may have gotten into the game after 1963, and you can see what a long ways we've come in the last 10 years. Needless to say, this has created problems for instrument designers, not to mention oscilloscope makers. Cutoff frequencies increasing like this have caused signals to increase in bandwidth tremendously. And if you're an instrumentation designer, you've had to follow that. It's been a real challenge. Another reason why we may need the benefits of intelligence and instrumentation are shown in this slide. You, the users, have continued to demand that instrument designers increase the capability that is contained in instrumentation, while simultaneously demanding that we lower the cost. I don't think I need to tell you that these are opposing demands. Because they are opposing demands, instrument designers have been scrambling to find all the resources they could to try to meet these demands. If you drop back and look at the instrumentation available in 1963 and compare it to that available today, I think they've done a very good job of meeting these demands in general. This is a blank slide and not the end, so don't turn up the lights. Before going on, I'd like to summarize that we have seen a couple of reasons why we may need intelligence and instrumentation. And now I'd like to look a little more at the details. I'd like to look at using intelligence in the instrumentation functions of acquisition, processing, and display. These we consider to be the three primary functions. Now we'll use some of those examples that I mentioned earlier. Let's consider this simple VOM. I've shown it here with a case off. I think you're mostly familiar with what it looks like with a case off. The probes laying there in front are the acquisition portion of this instrument. The resistive dividers and the switch form the processing portion, and the meter the display portion. The point I'm trying to make is that even a simple VOM has the functions of acquisition, processing, and display. If we look at a much more complex instrument, Tektronix Digital Processing Oscilloscope, I use this because this is an instrument I'm familiar with. Had I slides of somebody else's instrumentation, I would have preferred to use those. However, I find it difficult to obtain them at times. Therefore, what I'm showing you here is an instrument that's divided up along the three primary functions of acquisition, processing, and display. The lower portion there, the lower module containing the plugins, is the acquisition portion. The middle module with the buttons is the processing portion. The top module containing the CRT is the display portion. In this case, as in many cases, I think you can see walking around the exhibit area of Westcon, instruments are divided into modules, and the division is along the lines of acquisition, processing, and display. Since I'm talking about intelligence instrumentation, I wanted to briefly mention that the intelligence we use is a mini computer shown here with the instrument. The intelligence applies mainly to the processing function. Before we go on, I'd like to define intelligence. Since Rudy talked about it a little bit, I'd like to be a little bit more exacting. This is my definition. It's the ability to accept instructions and facts and carry out the instructions, including making decisions based upon the facts. Some examples of intelligent devices, or what I consider to be intelligent devices, are computers and programmable calculators. Computers are intelligent because they have the ability to accept instructions and facts or data, carry out the instructions, and make decisions based upon the facts. Those of you who are familiar with the assembly language of computers, you know they have what we call conditional branch instructions. If you're not familiar with that, think about simple if statements in Fortran or BASIC. That's making decisions based upon the facts. Programmable calculators likewise have this kind of capability. If they're BASIC-like, it's typically an if or a branch condition that they use for making decisions based upon the facts, and it's obvious that they are capable of accepting instructions and data. Therefore, computers and programmable calculators are an example of intelligence. I'm not excluding, by the way, microprocessors. I lump them with computers in general. They are also intelligent devices. As you may see later on, I think I'm probably a little bit biased in that respect. Now let's get down to looking at using the intelligence in instrumentation and seeing what it can do for you in the acquisition function. Basically, one of the points I'd like to make is a point that Dick made earlier. It can simplify your front panel tremendously. Use of intelligence with the acquisition function can do automatic operations and can reduce the need for a lot of complex knobs, dials, levers, switches on your front panels. As an example of this, one of the main examples I had was, consider the processing portion of the digital processing oscilloscope. That's much simpler than the portion below it. Although it performs very complex functions, the intelligence was deliberately used to make this as simple as possible. The paper just before this and the slides, I think, showed a very, very simple front panel, directly the result of using intelligence to simplify front panels. And for those of you who are bewildered by some of the front panels you find on instrumentation nowadays, I think you'll find this a welcome improvement. Another benefit that can be derived from using intelligence in the acquisition function is that of improving accuracy. This is done by using calibrated inputs to the device, by using the intelligence to measure the difference between the known value and the value it sees coming in through the instrument, and to store a table of errors. Then using the intelligence to correct the input data, using that table of errors to make it as correct as possible, as accurate as possible. When this is done automatically, we typically call this AutoCal. As I've shown here, without AutoCal, it's not too difficult to design instrumentation, analog instrumentation, to a couple of percent. With the use of intelligence and AutoCal, we can improve this accuracy by a factor of 10, getting down to 0.2%. Whoops, I'm sorry, I must have forgot to press the slide button. Okay, there's the point I'm trying to make. Without AutoCal, 2%. With AutoCal, 0.2%. And now before going on, I'd like to consider some of the benefits of using intelligence in the processing function. Briefly, some of the main benefits we see are that it's more precise. It's a digital type of processing in general, much more precise than analog processing. It's not limited by time or bandwidth. I'll elaborate on this point later. And before going on, I'd like to point out that using intelligence in the processing function requires a digitization of the data. This is a significant problem in itself, and it's a problem that could be the topic of a number of papers. I want to point out the problem and mention that digitizing the signals can be a problem. However, I'd like to leave it right there. Getting back to more precision in processing, we find that with the use of calculators or computers, we can obtain, let's say, up to 12 decimal places of precision in processing. If we assume round-off errors creep in to a couple of decimal places, that still leaves us processing errors in terms of 10 to the minus 10, tremendous precision in processing. It essentially eliminates the error in the processing function, and now your errors are associated merely with your acquisition and display functions. As I mentioned, time and bandwidth are not problems. Once the data has been digitized, the real-time aspects are removed. The time is simply a number with the data, or the bandwidth simply represented by the time or frequency with the data, and are not a function, are not a problem in the processing function. Let's consider integration of a signal. You can integrate signals very simply with a capacitor and resistor, or maybe more accurately with op amps. However, op amps run out of gas when you get up around the megahertz. You can go discrete on up a ways, but when you get to gigahertz, how do you integrate? It becomes very difficult. And for one instrument to do it all, it would be extremely difficult. However, if that instrument can digitize the data and then process it using intelligence, integration is really no problem over the entire range I described. As another example of this, let's consider spectral analysis via fast Fourier transform. The fast Fourier transform, one of the beauties of it is that it doesn't care about what the actual frequency was, like a spectrum analyzer does. It can analyze microhertz to gigahertz. It gets you the answers within seconds for a wide range of frequencies, unlike sometimes analog instrumentation. It also provides phase. And phase, as you, most of you know, is typically not available with a normal spectrum analyzer. I think it's a good example of what can be done with intelligence in the processing function. Of course, there are many other benefits of using intelligence in processing that are too numerous to mention, some of which were mentioned earlier by the first two speakers, I think, very well. I'd like to move on to talking about using intelligence in the display function. In this case, it's probably most obvious when we consider graphics. Let's consider this grid, for example. If we were to plot some data on that grid on a graphic device, such as a plotter or a graphic display terminal, the device driving this, usually an intelligent device like a computer, would need to send information about this grid before sending the data. It would need to send quite a bit of information concerning how to draw the vectors for the grid, the ASCII information, or whatever form it comes in, for the numbers along the grid and the positioning of these numbers along the grid. A great deal of information. Intelligence could be used to simplify the amount of information and amount of burden on the sending device by simply having the sending device send parameters about this grid, the number of lines and their spacing, the starting and stopping and the increments between the numbers. Let the intelligent device in the display function do the rest. I think you who are familiar with intelligent terminals have seen some of this used with intelligent terminals. Numerically then, I estimate that without intelligence, approximately 120 bytes of data would have been required to draw that previous grid and the numbers. With intelligence, it would be no problem to use 12 bytes to describe it in terms of parameters and then have the intelligence draw it. Or, one level above that, of course, completely automatic, is to have the intelligence look at the incoming data, determine the best grid for it, and automatically draw the grid based upon the data, completely relieving the computer or the device feeding the display from the problem of sending a reference grid along. Another benefit where intelligence can be used in the display function, typically graphically, is shown on this slide, whereby we talk about such things as scaling the display up or down in size, translating the display right or left, maybe windowing the display and blowing up the portion within that window, or rotating the display. All of these things are simply conversions on the data necessary or on the data that's there to be graphed and can be done very easily by an intelligent device. Another use of intelligence, probably not along the lines of acquisition, processing, or display, but directly related to using intelligence in instrumentation, is the problem of interfacing. I think all those of you who use many instruments and have tried to interface know the problem. It's still a problem. However, with the growing use of microprocessors, and I think you probably heard this mentioned yesterday in the section on microprocessors, they can be used very advantageously to do the interfacing function. Let's take a look at some of those advantages of using intelligence in the interfacing function. Intelligence can be used to an advantage over discrete logic because it occupies less space, consumes less power, and is more versatile. I'll talk about that a little bit more in the future. However, right now I'd like to look at several ways of implementing intelligence before we go on. Basically, we can implement intelligence as special purpose hardwired logic or as general purpose programmable structure. The special purpose hardwired logic is something such as a fast Fourier transform processor that's built completely out of hardwired logic. A general purpose programmable structure is a microcomputer, a mini computer, or a programmable calculator. These are what I consider to be the two basic methods of implementing intelligence, and probably most of the cases you presently see of intelligence and instrumentation uses these. Let's look at some of the advantages of the hardwired logic. The basic advantage I can think of is it's generally faster. That's the case with the hardwired fast Fourier transform processor. It is definitely a faster way to go than the other way. However, it contains a number of disadvantages, typically high cost, inflexible in terms of altering it to do different things, and it's difficult to design. It's a large digital structure, and those typically are difficult to design. If we consider general purpose programmable logic, the advantages are that it's lower in cost, it's more flexible, and it's easy to design. Usually lower in cost because you have a central processor with memory, and that's essentially the heart and the most of the device. Far fewer devices, far lower cost. It's more flexible because the logic is accomplished via software, and it's much more easy to change software than it is to change net circuit board, devices, etc. And for this reason, it's also more easy to design. There is one primary disadvantage. It tends to be slower. In some cases, it tends to be a lot slower. However, if the benefits outweigh the disadvantages, that's obviously the way to go. I'd like to drop back for a second now and talk a little bit about the overall advantages of intelligence and instrumentation. I think using intelligence and instrumentation, the advantages I've mentioned about acquisition, processing, and display, plus the advantages that we heard yesterday and I mentioned some of today of using a microprocessor for its small size and cost, are going to explode intelligence and instrumentation. It's a revolution that the mini computer has started. I think the microprocessor is probably going to really open it up. In the future, I see much wider use of intelligence and instrumentation, particularly microprocessors. And one of the things that I think probably will happen is multiprocessors and instrumentation. For instance, the functions of acquisition, processing, and display could each have a separate microprocessor associated with it, all working independently. Why would I think they would be working independently? Mainly because the problems associated with multiprocessors, in terms of software, are significant. These are problems that have been addressed by the very, very large mainframe manufacturers, and they're not trivial. And experience has shown that it takes time for these to filter down to the lower levels, such as microprocessors. The amount and the magnitude of these problems, the cost associated with solving them, I think will prevent software for multiprocessors for a while, and you'll tend to see multiprocessors but independent software for each one. Another thing I see in the futures is logic designers looking more at the whole instrument than they used to. No more are you going to be associated with a board. When you use a processor, chances are that's going to be the main logic of the instrument, and so you're going to be in the seat for determining the complete functioning of that instrument. Likewise, you're going to have to learn some software techniques. These are not difficult to learn, but a lot of logic designers have been looking at hardware and typically not software, and they're going to be faced with learning some of these techniques. Why do I think they need to learn some of these software techniques? May I have the next slide, please? Mainly because software determines the final use and capabilities of an instrument with intelligence, if the instrument is programmable, and in general, I think most of them will be because of the advantages of easy implementation and cost. Likewise, software can be used, as I indicated earlier, to smooth the man-machine interface. Fewer knobs, more meaningful knobs when you do have them. A lot of the nitty-gritty functions that you normally have to worry about taken away by AutoCAL and auto-scaling and these kind of things. However, one last point I would like to mention about software is it's not free. And that's why I think you're going to have to learn some software as instrument designers. It's not free in terms of dollars, and it's not free in terms of time. The dollars I mentioned are the dollars associated with the devices to store the program, the power, and the size of the instrument containing them. If you let your software get out of hand, it takes more memory, and it's going to take more space and more power to run that. The dollars are also not free in terms of time, because if your software is very crudely done, your instrument will take longer to execute its functions. It'll be much slower. And therefore, you're still faced with the problem of optimization. This time, it's optimization of software. I've tried to share with you in the last 20 minutes a few of the things we've learned the hard way. I hope that as you go down the road to using intelligence and instrumentation, both from a user's and a designer's point of view, that we can continue to improve instrumentation as much as it's improved over the last 10 years. Thank you.
Again, I think we should take a few seconds here to let you play the game of musical chairs. There are some warm chairs up here in the front, so you don't have to stand back there. Again, let me point out, I would appreciate receiving the feedback. I see most of you put it into the blue box back there. This helps us plan the sessions better next time around. Be frank in those, but factual. One of the points that was made by Bruce Hamilton concerns the question of the future. Well, I'll let you in on a little secret. This was one of the reasons why I am intrigued with these kinds of sessions is because I would like to find out more about the future, where we are going. And here, very clearly, we are at the threshold of a new revolution in electronics, which is brought about by the microprocessors. And any indication or any information that we can get on this as either users of instruments or builders of instruments, of course, will be to our advantage to try and maybe outguess for once what is going to happen tomorrow. We've had a very poor batting average in the past. Our last speaker in this series is Leo Chamberlain. Again, I will go through his background so that you get a better feeling for the speaker. He has received a BEE at Cornell University in 1952. After this, he was electronics officer on the DDR-831 USS Goodrich, I'm reading it exactly as he wrote it, for 35 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. And has joined as a sales engineer, Channel Radio Company, in 1955. I think there was a message there with that date. He has, after that, been associated with GR 1961 till 1961 at Syracuse. And I have to apologize, but I can't read that word, but he will tell you all about that. He was then a sales manager at GR till 1965, and in 1970 became the president of Time Data, which is a subdivision of General Radio, here in the Bay Area. The title of his talk is the same as the title of the session, Intelligence and Instrumentation. And I, after reading his paper, he tells me, of course, his talk is not going to be what the paper says. He doesn't believe in preprints. I think we will get some light shed on this question of intelligence, because quite frankly, I'm still puzzled. I still don't know for sure what intelligence is all about. So, Leo Chamberlain.
The word was sexual deviation. Rather than talk about how to design intelligence and where to do it, I like to talk about why to design intelligence and instrumentation, when and how much. I am eminently qualified to give this speech because I have a slide of transistor characteristics for 1953, which means I'm the oldest member of the group. Furthermore, I was never very good at arithmetic. There are two aspects of intelligence instrumentation, the way I look at it. One is the physical intelligence that should be built in the instrumentation, and secondly, the human intelligence required by the designer to decide how much and where to design it in. There's two kinds of what I consider ultimate intelligence in instrumentation. One is when it is truly automatic. There's no setup, there's no start-stop button, there's no human interpretation of the results required. That's intelligent. The second perfect or ultimate intelligence is where the instrumentation does everything, has maximum capability. There are two primary restraints to these neat definitions. One is economics. I have found the hard way that unless the user places a sufficient value on a solution, if it's not greater than the supplier cost, you're in deep serious trouble. So in other words, the supplier can spend so much to provide a solution that the person thinks is worth something. And the second restraint is time. Sometimes any solution may be more important than an automatic one. Well, the obvious question is how should a designer go about collecting the intelligence he needs to decide how much intelligence to put into the system? And the obvious question is what need does he intend to satisfy? Now, I will assume through my talk the analysis and control of electrical signals as an example. All my examples will concern signal processing. And I do this for two reasons. Number one, I work for a company that has that business. And number two, because I know something about it, having been in it for a while. If the needs of signal analysis and control can be categorized in broad application areas, and then a demand can be forecast for certain solutions in each of these areas, and just a few of them are chosen where a good demand exists, because there's no point in designing the perfect solution to a problem nobody has, although we do that very often, then specific users can be identified, and their specific needs should be able to be identified. There's two aspects of that. What does he think he needs, and what does the designer think he thinks he needs? There is a difference between the two, for those of you who have dealt with the combination marketing and engineering departments. The specific needs, what functions does he think he should measure? What major specifications does he think he requires? What operator interfaces does he think he needs? And what form of results does he think he needs? And what does he think he will need in the future? Now, I say all of that because there's a great difference between what the user thinks he needs and what the designer knows he needs. Finally, if in the future he in fact has certain needs for instrumentation, how will he recognize it? Will he recognize it because he's intelligent, or will he recognize it because you hit him in the head with a 2x4? The point being that the designer, in assessing these needs for a design, should avoid making it so general purpose that it doesn't do anything well, or have so much capability that no one can afford it. A general analysis like this was made at Time Data for signal analysis and control. A primary digital design was decided, and Bruce gave the reasons why. In this kind of work, the advent of the fast Fourier transform made it easy to satisfy the need for both auto and cross functions of signals. There was a need for higher accuracy than available with analog design. There was a need for wider dynamic range. And there was a need for flexible systems for a very simple reason. Most of the applications were in research and development, where people didn't really know what they wanted, and in fact, in many cases, still don't. The market for specific instrumentation to solve specific problems seemed very small, because the entire field, the capabilities of this kind, these algorithms, is just still being literally used. Now, more analysis of the prospect was required. What was his knowledge with, in this case, statistics and time series analysis? What is the difference between autospectral and power spectral density? What is continuous real-time bandwidth? What are anti-aliasing filters? That was an absolutely foreign word to me 3 years ago, but after a great deal of study, I'm glad to say now that it is only quasi-foreign. What is his jargon? What terms does he know? Does he say double precision or dynamic range? Does he say filter bandwidth? Does he say frequency range? What terms doesn't he know? Does he recognize lines of resolution, double precision, statistical independence, block transfer? There is two worlds, I'm sure. There's a digital world and an analog world. The analog world tends to think of things in tens, and the digital world tends to think in things of pairs. I am a convert to the second world. The mini computer was chosen as a heart of a system to solve all of these needs for four reasons, and again, Bruce touched on them. To accommodate user interfaces, which seem to be key, because why is a system of any value unless someone can operate it? And two, to satisfy varying requirements for real-time bandwidth. The seismic people have a different bandwidth than the gigahertz fellas. And finally, to provide maximum flexibility, because in fact, no one knows exactly what should be built. Finally, to satisfy those three requirements, to allow an economic solution. The general purpose nature of the mini computer, the programmable calculator, or the microprocessor allows this. Now let's have some examples. Next slide. First slide, please. Is that in focus? Oh, thank God. A basic digital signal processing system consists of a digital input or an analog input. If it's analog, it probably should be anti-aliased filtered. It has to be converted to digital data, goes into a core, has to be controlled. It probably is processed, probably converted back to analog so that somebody can interpret it, and some operator has to control it. That's a very simple, simple look at how to do it. This is device produced by Time Data Corporation in 1966. It was, I think, the first commercially available FFT analyzer. I can say that because I wasn't there. And it turned out to be a standalone instrument without a mini computer. Next slide, please. All of those funny knobs and dials surrounding that same console were discovered to be required to solve problems because that single instrument didn't quite hack it. It was flexible, but not flexible enough. Interestingly enough, the peripheral devices were to make more flexible inputs and more flexible displays. In 1970, the second generation device came out, and this it was in two forms. You see up at the top the horrible purple, with all due respect to Mr. Digital. The 1105, the 1115 computer came out, and there's the heart of the system, but there was an operator panel designed in the language of the user, because interestingly enough, most people who make signal analysis measurements were brought up in the analog world and truly did not understand the funny digital talk. So the panel was designed to be in their language, and they really thought that they were operating just any other analog panel, but the computer was doing a much better job for them than the analog circuitry did. And for the people who did understand time series analysis, a keyboard was designed because it was obviously more flexible. The algorithms could be gathered one by one and put in clever combinations to solve unique problems. Now, with the advent of something like 7 years of experience, the system presently being promulgated, I think is the word, by Time Data, is very simple indeed. It's only those three white boxes plus the teletype. I wonder why these slides are all in different focus. You don't suppose that the person who took them... No. Those three devices there, that oscilloscope is the readout. If you go back to that block diagram in your mind, the operator interface is the teletype, the analog-to-digital filters, and the, or analog-to-digital converter and digital-to-analog converters behind a panel, and there's no knobs and dials. And the reason there isn't is because the language for that particular operation is a BASIC-like language invented by Time Data called TSL, or Time Series Language. And it is a very simple interactive language, which we use and which is very easily learned, to be able to program a very flexible, very wide number of problems, calls algorithms like an FFT algorithm or arithmetic algorithms, transfer function, everything. This particular example, what we're doing here is making a chirp. Actually, we're going to take the direct Fourier transform of a chirp. We made the function. We went to a sine table to convert it to a sine with increasing frequency, and then took the direct Fourier transform of it, and I think there was something like 8 commands to do that. But the supposition here is that somebody knows what he's doing. Somebody understands time series analysis and in fact knows how to put the algorithms together. So the second solution is to add a panel to that same system. And you may notice that the boxes are identical, except now one has some knobs and dials. And if that would be put in focus, one could see that if you look at the words, they're the words that the user thinks when he makes a measurement. Almost everybody who makes a measurement or wants to solve something visualizes the results before he starts. And then he sets up to, in terms of the results that he expects to get. And that's exactly how you design a panel. You may ask why anyone in his right mind would choose a funny purple and a weird pink. And if you remember the appearance of the computer at the top, you'll know why. The multicolors is because we are in a time frequency world, and one color is for time functions and time parameters, and the other color is for the frequency functions and the frequency parameters. So now, put them all together, and we have a panel system. In this case, however, suppose there's a specific application and one doesn't want the general purpose nature. Let us suppose that someone wishes to have a closed loop random vibration control system. Someone has a shaker. He'd like to be able to specify for that shaker a certain PSD for an unknown specimen, and then he'd like to run tests. Well, what one does is just cover up the funny colors on the panel with an overlay, and that overlay happens to be one which is specifically for random vibration control. And now the language of that panel is in the language of the random vibration control man, the environmental test man, which is completely different than time series or even electronics. Or he might wish to do sinusoidal vibration control instead of random, in which case the words are different. Or he might be interested in doing a shock spectrum analysis, in which case the words are yet different. Or he may wish to do shock spectrum synthesis, or transient waveform control, in which case, again, the words are different. The reason that the words are the same on the left side of the panel is because they're the input words. So then what anyone can do is say, what about speeds? And Bruce Hamilton touched on this. He said the main advantage of the hardwired FFT processor was speed. And he's exactly right. He's listened carefully to the things that I've told him these many years. And we see that with a combination of different computers, which are all general purpose but have different speeds, if one has a software processing capability, one has one real-time bandwidth. If we add a hardwired cosine generator, we get a little faster speed. If we ask a Fourier processor, we get a little more speed. If we add a Fourier processor with a cosine generator, we get, yes sir, a little bit more speed. And then if we put on a larger processor with more complications and much harder to design, and he's right, they are, you get a certain speed and you just keep on going up. So there's a tremendous flexibility in the real-time bandwidth choices one has, depending on which computer he uses. This is an example. It's an identical system to the one you saw before, but now it uses a PDP 1135 instead of an 05, and as a consequence, is faster. Or one designs a Fourier hardwired processor, which is a little one rather than a big one, and gets a certain speed. This one happens to be 4 kilohertz. One plugs it into a computer itself or a computer extension box, and lo and behold, he has a very fancy extended arithmetic element, which happens to be specialized in doing time series. Or he really gets fancy and produces a 1500 IC device to really do things fast. The other advantage, of course, of this intelligent general-purpose computer with hardwired microprocessors and what have you is in the input. One can have a fantastically flexible input. In this case, we can have, well, first of all, we can either use a multiplexed approach or a scanning approach. We can have anti-aliasing filters or not. We can have the amplifiers or not. We can have the sample or hold or not. All of this business fits in a box which is called the ACE, meaning two things, analog conditioning element for the serious people in the organization, and by the designer, he thought it was, in fact, an ACE. It's a very live crew we have here today. Thank you very much. The point I'm trying to make is that the flexibility of from one to name the channels one wishes is just literally adding a little bit of hardware and a little bit of software, if in fact it's truly modular. So we end up with a typical system, and a typical system can have a panel control or keyboard control or time series control. It can have an XY recorder. It can have a large oscilloscope and a hard copy unit. It can have a rugged teletype. It can have a visicorder. It can have just about as many outputs as anybody really desires. Another system can have an XY recorder vertically instead of horizontally. It can have a high-speed punch and reader, and a different kind of teletype. This happens to be the DEC LA30. One can add an 1145 computer, and then we have still a different system. The point that I'm trying to make with all of these seemingly biased pictures are the flexibility that one has in a system like this. This happens to be a vibration laboratory. If you look hard on the right, you see an electrohydraulic shaker, and that man happens to be, instead of using a teletype to control it, a terminal. I didn't realize that a terminal like that was an intelligent terminal until Bruce just told me. But that's an intelligent terminal, so he's talking to the shaker through the terminal, and the truly automatic operation. He does the setup of the terminal and then pushes a button. We tried very, very hard not to have a start-stop button, and we had some very good ideas, clapping, smiling, lots of ways to get it to go, and we reverted back to the start-stop button. Finally, from our point of view as a company with the coup de grace, is when one puts three FFT processors in parallel and has 16 inputs and 16 outputs and does practically everything from what the signals that come in to the signals that go out. And this, to us so far, is the ultimate of flexibility. It has digital frequency translation. It has analog tape input. And we did have a coffee maker in the rear of the machine and decided against it because the incremental cost was greater than the supplier would pay. point that I'm trying to make is that each of these systems was designed to satisfy the needs of a specific application, and the reason that it was able to do that was because it, in fact, uses a mini computer, in fact, uses the programming capabilities of a computer, and has the right kind of hardware that plugs around, so that the physical intelligence and instrumentation is almost unlimited. But it requires human intelligence to decide how much to put in. It depends on the applications, the characteristics of the user, the value that the user places on a solution, and the cost that the supplier must use to solve that need. This involves economic trade-offs among performance, the ease of operation, and ultimately the cost. And successful instrumentation systems, and this is the point that we break on, successful instrumentation